Okay.
Back before Missouri was a state, in 1818, Henry Rowe Schoolcraft walked across the Ozarks. He left Potosi in eastern Missouri and returned 90 days later, having covered almost 900 miles. The journal that he published the following year recounts the plants and animals that he saw. My name is Trevor Harris, and in a special series, we look at how parts of the Missouri landscape have changed in the 200 years since Schoolcraft walked through the plateaus and valleys along the St. Francis, White, and James Rivers. In this, the second episode of The Landscapes of Henry Rowe Schoolcraft, we hear from a quartet of residents of Howell County, Missouri. In the next half hour, you'll hear from a rancher, a sawmill operator, a nonprofit director, and an activist discussing the forces that have altered the landscape since whites first settled the thin soils of the Missouri Ozarks. In November 1818, Henry Rowe Schoolcraft and travel companion Levi Pettibone started walking southwest from Potosi, now the county seat of eastern Missouri's Washington County. They walked down the Big Piney River Valley between the modern-day cities of Houston and Kabul. Schoolcraft later wrote that they encountered few white settlers. They spotted a few abandoned summer Indian hunting camps. They passed through open areas covered in flowers and grass with few trees. They also walked through massive stands of native pine. The men regularly saw elk, bear, turkey, and wolves. Where rifles would have best suited their hunting needs, the men instead brought along handguns. Schoolcraft admitted in his journal that once he was on the trip, he was woefully unprepared for what laid ahead. Howell County, Missouri lies along the Missouri-Arkansas border, about 4 hours south of Columbia. County seat, West Plains. Thick forest covers the largely undeveloped lands along the North Fork of the White River as it flows south, just west of West Plains. Schoolcraft walked through this area. Here's West Plains resident Hank Dorst reading a passage from Schoolcraft's Ozarks Journal.
Sunday, November 22nd, 1818. The difficulties attending our process along the banks of the river induced us this morning to take the highlands, where we found the traveling much easier, both to ourselves and our horse. On quitting the Valley of the Limestone, we held a due west course for about 2 miles in order completely to disengage ourselves from the pine forest, the ravines, and the brush bordering the right bank of the river, when we found ourselves on an open barren with very little timber or underbrush and generally level. We now altered our course to south-southwest and traveled in a direct line 14 miles without meeting anything worthy of remark. We passed over a sterile soil, destitute of wood, with gentle elevations, but no hills or cliffs, and no water. Night was closing fast around us, and as the sky darkened, the wind began to rise, and it murmured among the pines which crowned the high bluffs by which we were encompassed. It seemed to forebode that we were destined to pass a cheerless night. We almost involuntarily stopped to survey the scene around us, and at this moment observed a small spring of water trickling among the stones at our feet. And turning toward its source, a cave in the rock, situated about midway up the bluff, yawned before us. Monday, November 23rd. We then followed the stream down the valley about 3 miles and came to the banks of the stream we had left the day before. A considerable change in the face of the country has taken place. Instead of rich bottoms, we have a high oak prairie. The perpendicular bluffs and the pine have also disappeared, and in their place we have long sloping hills covered by oaks. The stream has also visibly increased in size and is now deep enough to float a keelboat of 20 tons burden. Thinking it had received a considerable tributary from the left bank at no great distance above, we tied our horse and pursued up several miles, but were mistaken. On returning, we followed down about 3 miles and encamped on the banks of the river, distance 10 miles.
That was Ozarks resident Hank Dorst reading an excerpt from the Ozarks Journal of Henry Rowe Schoolcraft. You're listening to The Landscapes of Henry Rowe Schoolcraft, a three-part series that imagines what Schoolcraft saw when he walked through southern Missouri in 1818 and 1819. In the almost 200 years since Schoolcraft's epic Missouri trip, we look at how the place is the same and how it's different. Major forces that have altered the plant and animal species mix in the two centuries since Schoolcraft's visit include fire suppression, agriculture, and timbering. We'll deal with fire in the next episode. First up this week, we look at agriculture and how it's altered the Ozarks since Schoolcraft's time. Colin Collins is a Howell County farmer and rancher. He's lived on and worked with the land near the Arkansas border for a lifetime. His labors have made Collins a keen observer of landscape changes. Here, he reflects on how farming and ranching have evolved during his lifetime.
In the 1960s, when I went off to college, and there was forage production for cattle was very difficult, and there was no such thing as fescue grass. Now, when I came back from college, fescue had literally taken over the Ozarks and was one of the best things that ever happened to to our farming economy, because all of a sudden we now had a grass that would grow in cool seasons, and we were able to grow many more cattle here than we ever could before. So the transition from kind of subsistence, diversified hogs, milk, eggs, chickens, all changed, and most everybody became a beef rancher and had cows, beef cows, and sold the calves at young weights because we had no real feed to feed them. But fescue grass allowed all of that to happen. And certainly from the 60s up through 2000, the beef cattle market, what you could get for your beef cows was very up and down and relatively small margin levels, and so there was most everybody that farmed or had beef cows had another job in town, and the size of their farm was relatively small, less than 160 acres usually, and had just a few cows. So we went from a subsistence level situation like what my father farmed, and that's all he ever did his whole life, to where in fact there were jobs to be had in town in manufacturing, and you could still live out on the farm and have a few cows. So that's what evolved. The issue continues to be that there's not much margin in cattle until these last few years, last 3 or 4 years. We've really had a surge in the prices, but the local individual farmer in this part of most of the Ozarks just couldn't amass enough land because it's gotten more and more expensive, and the productivity of the land was such that it just made it very difficult for someone to make a true living just off of beef cattle, which is primarily exactly what most everybody does. So we've kind of evolved into a situation where we've got a few larger farmers that have fairly large beef cattle operations. We have many what I call farmers still having a job somewhere in town and living out in the countryside, still having some ties back to their family who were even farming more. And then we have very few like ourselves that are diversified and are doing many different kinds of farming operations. It's difficult to get into. The capital requirements are fairly staggering for a young person, and without family help, certainly without probably some inheritance of some type of the land and or the cattle, it's very difficult to get into farming, and beef cattle farming in particular.
That was Howell County native Colin Collins. He raises row crops and beef cattle on his land near West Plains, Missouri. While he's been busy focusing on numerous entrepreneurial ventures, Collins has also watched the environment around his property. Here he discusses the changes he's observed in plant and animal species during his lifetime.
The plants have changed and the animals have changed dramatically. When I grew up, if we saw a deer, and I want to say when I grew up, and this is in the 50s and 60s, if we saw a deer, that was something to talk about. And there was a deer season, but we never hunted them because there was none to hunt. And I never deer hunted or shot a deer till I came back in the mid 70s. And now they are a pest for us, and we literally have to try to control them with controlled hunts on our ground. And turkeys, when I first was told there was wild turkeys in the Ozarks, I thought they were lying because it couldn't be. There's never been any here. Why would they be here now? And now they're everywhere. Well, on the other side, one of the things we really enjoyed doing as a kid was quail hunting, and now we might see a quail every once in a while. I haven't actually been quail hunting on our farm in 30 years, probably. They're just gone, and I really don't know why. Foxes were very prevalent when I was growing up, and we had to worry about rabid foxes. Now we see very few foxes, but lots of coyotes, and people hunt the coyotes. We didn't even have them back in the 50s, and it's probably an evolution back more towards closer to where Schoolcraft would have seen in his time. As he talks about elk, of course, we've never seen any elk in our part of the world, but they were obviously here back in his day, and the deer must have been fairly plentiful, as well as turkey, as he talks about.
That was Howell County farmer and rancher Colin Collins. While agriculture has had a major impact on the Ozarks in the 200 years since Henry Rose Schoolcraft walked through the area, logging has probably had an even greater influence on the forest, prairies, and barrens that Schoolcraft described in his journal. Mike Renfro owns and operates a sawmill in southern Howell County, Missouri. He's been in the timber industry now for 40 years.
This particular mill, I opened it in 2008, which was not very good timing considering a recession. We started in late 2008, but I've been in the industry over 40 years. I was in the hardwood flooring business, had a hardwood flooring mill at another location here in the West Plains area. When we sold our mill 10 years ago, this particular location was part of that, and the new owners didn't want the sawmill part, so I bought that back and reopened it at that time.
So how did you come to be involved in forest products in the first place?
Well, I really, that question's been asked by my family. My father, he was an engineer. My mother was 40 plus years in teaching school. My sisters were all involved in school teaching, and I guess I'm considered the black sheep of the family. But I got out of college in 1978, and just could not figure out. I went to school to coach and to be a teacher like my parents were, basically, and just couldn't find myself doing that. I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to be tied down to that type of work. And I'd been involved in this business when I was a teenager for summer work, part-time work in the summers. And I don't know what it was, really. I got back involved in it. I liked the type of work. I liked being outdoors. I got involved in logging when I was in my early 20s, and I really, really enjoyed that part of it. And that's really changed from then to now. It just kind of got in my blood. I got involved in it, and then at a certain point in your life, you kind of got to make that decision if you're going to stay with something or move on, and I stayed and made a career out of it. So it's been a good decision for me. I've made a good living, and I had my son-in-law involved in this business, and it's kind of more of a turned into more of a family type business. So my son has children, my son-in-law has children, so hopefully they'll have an interest down the road someday. But really, that's how I got involved. I don't know. It wasn't by necessity by any means. It's a hard business. There's financial restraints. I mean, buying timber, buying equipment, things like that. It's not for everyone. Let's put it that way. But it has been for me, I guess.
That was Howell County, Missouri sawmill operator Mike Renfro. The forest industry has undergone significant changes in the 40 years since Mike Renfro started working at a sawmill as a young man. This is the second episode of a three-part series, The Landscapes of Henry Rose Schoolcraft. In the series, we examine the forces that have altered southern Missouri in the 200 years since Schoolcraft walked through. His journal remains one of the best accounts we have of our state's pre-settlement vegetation and species mix. Here, sawmill operator Mike Renfro reflects on the forces that have changed in the timber industry in the four decades since he's been involved in forestry.
It has and hasn't changed. Southern Missouri timber industry is still, I call it, like sometimes the 1950s, or the technology has changed at some places, but there is a lot of small mom-and-pop mills still left in this country that are doing stuff that they were doing, you know, 30, 40 years ago. You still see that. And then you see people like what we're doing out here that's more involved in technology. We've got computers in our mill. You know, we got our logging equipment. You know, we're more mechanized now than we used to be. We're not expecting people to use chainsaws and fall trees. I'd say the biggest change I've seen is probably safety. Machinery is being more safe to operate. People not, you know, the people getting hurt and things like that, which, you know, that can still happen. But I've just seen a big change in that. And really on a higher production level, you know, machines have changed. And that's happened a lot just because of the labor force. You know, it's just harder and harder and harder to find people that want to do this type of work. And if you can replace a person with a machine, it's just that machine's going to be here every Monday morning.
Over 40 years in the industry, how have you seen that the available wood change?
Well, you know, actually, people weren't very good stewards back in the early days. When I first came up, there was a lot of land clearing being done in the southern part of Missouri, and people didn't really value their timberland. Of course, it just wasn't valued. The value of it wasn't that good, or compared to what it is now. And you know, land prices were considerably less than what they are now, and people just didn't value timber. The cattle industry is big in southern Missouri, and people wanted to clear their land for, you know, grazing practices and things like that. I saw that aspect of it. I remember back in the Reagan days, Ronald Reagan days, and that was in the 80s, the Forest Service was all about cutting timber. I mean, they cut everything. It was just humongous clear cuts out here, which probably public perception of that was awful. And that, to me, was kind of the wrong way to do things. But then in the 90s, they kind of just locked it all back down, and we kind of had a shortage of timber for a while. And then here in the last 10 years or so, they've kind of opened that back up, and there's been more of availability of timber. Now, the quality of timber, I think, was probably better 30, 40 years ago than it is now. That's probably a whole other can of worms, but it just seems like, probably the availability of timber, people think all their timber's gone, but I think there's actually more now than there was back then. Public doesn't understand, doesn't see it like I do, but it really grows back pretty quickly. And I've seen places we've cut 2 and 3 times, you know, that are you cut them back in the day, and they're ready to cut again. Spring River Lumber.
This is Trevor Harris, and you're listening to the second episode of a 3-part series, The Landscapes of Henry Rose Schoolcraft. This episode of the series looks at agriculture and timbering as major forces of landscape change in the Ozark region. There are visionaries who imagine what a restored Ozark's landscape might look like. One of those people is Hank Dorst. We heard him reading earlier in the program from the Ozark's Journal of Henry Rose Schoolcraft.
You know, everybody has their ideal forest. Most of us do, you know, which is big old trees, widely spaced, but what they call the park-like vision, and also going back to man's roots on the savannas of Africa, you know, swinging from the trees a little bit and then jumping down into the grass. And incidentally, that happens to be the pre-settlement condition of a lot of the Ozarks vegetation, was widely spaced trees over a grassy understory with lots of flowers, forbs. That's kind of a vision, but there's a lot of pieces to get to that vision, and it's not appropriate in every location, and you certainly can't go back. You can't roll the clock back everywhere. You can maybe try and succeed in a few places. But while you're rolling the clock back, you're also producing timber. So Tim Nye from MDC used to say, when he talked about pre-settlement vegetation and modern forest management, he would say, We come across a piece of ground and we should ask ourselves, what was this? What was here? What was this like? How is it different? And then once we've come up with an idea of what we think was here, the question is, can we work with that? Can it be restored? Many, many cases, the cost of restoration and the time required is going to be not produce anything that's value to society in the shorter and midterm, the way we tend to think. But at other times, woodland restoration is appropriate and can work perfectly with timber management, thinning the forest, instituting a fire regime. And so Tim came up with this conceptual approach to management 20 years ago. That's always guided me ever since. And I think it guides a lot of people in public forest management. You know, people are really more aware now of what used to be on site and how that may influence what they can do with that site now. Schoolcraft is probably the most important of the original sources, the primary sources. And the other original primary source would be the surveyor's records from the General Land Office. And they made descriptions of the land in general, and they noted the trees, their marker trees. And so you can go back and reconstruct the spacing of the trees and what the species were on every acre of land in the country. Basically what Schoolcraft was. He was a white man who was literate, and he was noticing the natural world, and he wrote it down. So it's invaluable. As someone with Nature Conservancy recently said, Doug Ladd recently said, imagine if Schoolcraft had a camera when he was here. There's a vast body now of historical research and scientific investigation that has reconstructed the pre-settlement land type associations and the plant species and the animal species. And Schoolcraft is at the heart of that, but all that's kind of flowed from Schoolcraft.
That was Ozark resident Hank Dorst. He's devoted a large part of his now over 30 years in the Ozarks to working with and sometimes fighting with the U.S. Forest Service. His efforts center around creating a healthy and balanced forest. While Dorst is concerned with the ecological future of the Ozarks, another individual in West Plains is looking at how young Ozarkers see themselves, their history, and their prospects for making a living in the Ozark Hills and Hollows. Jim McFarlane is a West Plains native. After 30 years running the local Ramada Inn, McFarlane was in search of a new challenge. He signed on a few years ago to lead West Plains-based Trillium Trust. The group has a plan to mark the campsites of Henry Rowe Schoolcraft, and in the process, they'll educate travelers about the context in which Schoolcraft existed.
Trillium Trust is a small nonprofit based here in West Plains, but its footprint is over the entirety of the Ozarks Plateau, reaching from basically Springfield or St. Louis, Missouri, southwest down towards the Buffalo River region. Our one-line mission is to help sustain and support the Ozark spirit. Of course, that means a lot of different things for a lot of different people, and we intentionally set it that way so that we wouldn't be confined to how we might interact with our friends and neighbors. We've proposed to set a series of 50 key locations. We call them keys. They're QR codes, which are quick response codes that individuals with smartphones can scan these squiggly code-looking things that you see on the bottoms of cereal boxes and multiple other retail things. But that scan from your smartphone can take you to a website that would, as we develop this, take you to the history of the point you're standing at right at that moment. So, for instance, Topaz over here in the upper reaches of the North Fork of the White River, where Schoolcraft and his sidekick camped a few days and looked out across the spring there, the individual can find out what that's about and that part of the Schoolcraft story. By doing it with this form of technology, we feel like people can then more or less do self-guided tours. And at the same time, we hope to engage the young demographic, the 18, 25, 35-year-old demographic, in part by having that smartphone that they already go to for Googling information, texting, Skyping, all of those different things. That, in turn, we hope engages that group to find more of interest to them, what's relevant about it to them, and therefore maybe take a pride in who they are and where they come from. Having been born and raised in West Plains, I've had family here since the 1880s, and to me, and I understand, I'm a 63-year-old man, but to me, as I walk through my community, I recognize that I'm walking across some of the same paths that my parents, my grandparents, and my great-grandparents walked across. And I think that kind of makes me feel like, since I know where I came from, gives me a pride in who I am. And that's really what we're shooting at for this whole project, is helping young people to understand just how tenacious their forefathers were to live in this area.
That was Jim McFarland. He leads the West Plains-based nonprofit Trillium Trust. That group aims to help a new generation of Ozark residents learn about their shared history while cultivating a pride of place. Thanks to Jim McFarland, Colin Collins, Mike Renfro, and Hank Dorst. Thanks also to the Missouri Humanities Council, the National Endowment for the Humanities, Missouri Life Magazine, and the Missouri Department of Conservation for their valuable contributions to this radio series. The series concludes with Episode 3 in 2 weeks, when we head west from the White River Valley to the Kickapoo Prairie, now better known as Springfield. It was on his walk there in the last days of 1818 that explorer Henry Rowe Schoolcraft went looking for mining potential and found vast prairies, mining in caves for the essence of gunpowder, and seasonal Osage hunting camps. Music on this evening's program came from the Fantods, recorded live at AIDS Downtown Antiques in West Plains. They are Steve Markley, Dennis Kreider, Gary Dew, and Dana Leak. For the executive producer of Thinking Out Loud, this is Trevor Harris. Thanks for listening to the landscapes of Henry Rowe Schoolcraft on KBIA.